New topic. Everybody comfortable with fetal status? Okay, good.
I'd like to have stable fetus.
So I want to show you guys this picture that's on the cover in color. It doesn't do justice in black and white. It's a very dramatic picture.
Can you pass it
around? If you read the caption over there, this picture is used, not surprisingly, by the anti-abortion people.
Wow.
See the cute little fetal hand coming and coming up to the surgeon's finger. But that's not our agenda today. We're more interested in what's going on with the surgery. So if I wanted to give an advertisement for the medical profession, I would say that when it comes to most things, Baruch Hashem, most acquired disease, or disease that presents itself after birth, the medical profession has done very, very well. And could always do better, right? But in terms of fighting infectious disease, and fighting even Rachman Al-San cancer or something like that, there has been, without going into any detail, tremendous progress. One area that is always the biggest challenge is congenital disease. That's something where medicine finds itself always behind in the attack. So down the road, genetic engineering, which we touched upon a little bit, is certainly going to be the future to taking care of congenital defects. You know, taking the genes out and actually working on them, correcting them, and then moving forward, and that would be probably the most dramatic way of settling congenital disease. But that's like sort of, I wouldn't call it science fiction. It's something that is in the parsha, but what's really practical nowadays, it's certainly that's years away, what is practical nowadays is fetal surgery. That's the closest we can get to really mamish preventing some of the ill effects of congenital disease. What am I talking about? For example, there's a condition I hope none of you are familiar with. It's called the congenital diaphragmatic hernia. What does that mean? There's always fancy names in medicine, right? But it's always something very simple. There's a diaphragm. We all have a diaphragm. Right? And the diaphragm separates our abdominal contents from our chests for very good reason. And when there's a hernia, as everybody's familiar with the word hernia, there is a hole or some kind of tear in that diaphragm that allows some of the intestines or the liver or whatever is in the abdomen to make its way up to the chest. It's a horrible condition. Why is it a horrible condition? Not so much because of the abdominal contents being out of the abdomen, because that could just be put right back in, right? Just put it back in, sew it up. That wouldn't be such a big deal. The problem is, anyone have an idea? Any medically oriented thinkers? What would be the problem in a fetus who early on has this problem? What do you think would be the real trouble? What's it going to impact upon? Development of the lungs. Right, that's the real problem. The contents go up into the lungs, compress the lungs, the lungs don't develop normally, and that's what kills a large percentage of these babies. It's a horrible diagnosis. You know, for years it was almost like there is some degree, a spectrum of how bad it could be, but the bad ones were always uniformly fatal. Just a horrible, horrible diagnosis. Then, about 10 years ago, people started saying, okay, there's nothing we could do with these kids at birth. It's just too late because the lungs don't develop. You can't make them develop after they're not developed. That's something that has to take place in utero. So what, if you were a chacham, what would you think to do? In utero, get to the problem, fix it then, and then you'll be able to have lungs fully developed. That was the beginning of fetal surgery. They thought with this particular disease, it's the only way we're going to get any progress. And they were able to have some successes, and it is now offered to anyone who, Rachmana Litzlan, is told that their fetus has this particular problem. Why would I choose, as a topic to talk to you guys, even though I know you're all interested in these esoteric medical topics, Why fetal surgery? How common is it? Not that common. But within this topic of fetal surgery, what we hopefully will see are bread and butter halachic biomedical issues. Really, the bread and butter. You'll see as we go through it. And that's why it's kedai to do this issue, starting with a case that I'm going to give you. And I want to generate some input from you guys. I'm going to give you an actual case that happened to me. And the shiloh that was asked to me, is a medical shiloh. I'm going to present it to you as a halachic shiloh. Right? And we're going to try to develop what type of halachic considerations have to be put into place when this type of issue arises. What am I talking about? So if you look at the bottom of the first page, you don't have to read that if you don't want to. It's describing an innovative procedure, also analogous to what I just described going on with that congenital diaphragmatic hernia, where there'll be a procedure done in utero. Here's what happened to me. I might have mentioned this to you, I don't remember if I did, in the very beginning of the year. I was in the hospital minding my own business, and one of my colleagues is a very big, a world-famous advocate of this procedure. And they were sitting there advising this young from couple. And obviously, this person who is a big advocate of this procedure was advocating they should do this procedure. What was the problem with the baby? Without getting into too much boring cardiology, there is a condition. You just have to know a little bit to understand the issues, where, again, the heart has a blockage going outside of the heart. And the blockage per se is not a big deal. Blockages could always be opened, right? What's the problem? Because of this blockage, the chamber behind that aorta, the artery that comes out of the heart, the left ventricle, which is the most important part of the heart, doesn't develop. And it's hypoplastic is the word we use. And these babies that are born, we have a procedure that we can take care of them. But when there's a certain variant of this, 90% of them, by 1 month, will be gone. 90% or more. It's not viable. The procedure here, again, is in utero to open up this artery and prevent the whole thing. If the procedure works and is done right, you can have a baby with a full life. Okay? So, at this point, what would you tell them to do, right? If the baby just, Shev al Tasa, gets allowed to be born as is, we could do surgery, but there's like a greater than 90% mortality rate on 1 month of age. If we go in there, right, and open this up, Chai Olam, the baby can live forever. Yitz Hashem, right? Have a full life. What's the no-brainer advice to do? Do the procedure, right? Why not?
Mother.
What's the important consideration here? Well, the mother is one. What else? What should you be asking? What are these people asking? What's the first question they should ask? What's the risk of the procedure itself? That's always the question, right? No one should ever need it, but always ask that question. What is the risk of the procedure to the baby and to the mother? So, the risk of that procedure at the time that this was going on, the conversation, 12 had been done in the world, 1 successfully, 11 died right away. Not great odds.
It died in the womb or when they came out?
Right at the procedure. This is not an easy thing to do. I mean, if you can imagine what's involved, I'll give you a little flavor. You have to take a catheter that goes through the belly of the mother, through the uterus, through the chest of the infant, then through the heart, without getting too graphic, needle your way, and we're talking about, a fetus who's small. For this to make a difference, you have to do it relatively early on in the pregnancy. And, everyone knows the old rule that your heart size is about the size of your fist. So, these tiny, look at that little hand. Right? So we're talking about a heart that size, right? Then you got to thread up this little balloon catheter and open up this area. It's a very difficult procedure. It's crazy. It's mom's crazy. I got to tell you, it's crazy. I never, even from a total secular medical standpoint, I said to this colleague of mine, you're crazy. So now these people noticed me with my yarmulke, right? What's a frum couple who's getting medical advice? They see a frum doctor in that field standing around. It's a natural thing. Can we talk to you for a minute? Okay, I knew it. But in this case, I was happy because I knew what my colleague was doing. I knew she's a very nice person. But she's really advocating. This was going to be her claim to fame. And she was advocating doing this, and she figures, why? And she's a nice person, and yet she's advocating this because she knows that there's greater than a 90% chance that this fetus is not going to make it anyway. Let's give him a shot. So they asked me, what should we do? We have a greater than 90% chance of Nisa Miyad. We have a greater than 90% chance that if the baby is born within a month, there'll be a Nisa. So I said, you're asking me medically, right? So I told them, I wouldn't do it. I think there's many reasons Sheva Tasa is always preferable from a totally non-halachic perspective. Just the notion of, from one simple perspective, it's better that if the odds are 90-90 both those ways, so you can look at it in a Pashut way and say, Shev Altasa, let Shamayim take care of things and not have a person be the executioner. It's like, a Pashut Svara to the Shev Altasa. It might even have halachic implications, we'll see. But, Baruch Hashem, these type of decisions we don't approach that way, right? That's what this course is all about. We approach it from a halachic perspective. So, they weren't asking me, obviously, for a psak. They wouldn't in a million years. But I naturally began to think about this a lot. It was the impetus for me to getting into this topic. What would halacha say about this? So just somebody give me some suggestions. What issues are relevant? If you were going to break it down, what are the halachic issues? There are at least five major issues that are bread and butter bioethical issues that need to be answered to get anywhere with this case.
Which way is more a chance that the baby's going to...
Well, it's not that easy. I'm not making it. The reality was 90-90, right? But there's another factor there. What are we talking about? 90% what?
Baby.
That'll be chai what? Shah, right? Anyone familiar with those expressions? Those terms? Chai shah, chai olam. That is a famous issue in bioethics. Can you... What?
Can you review those?
Yes. Well, there's a little bit of discussion about what exactly they are, but the consensus opinion is Chai Olam is based on Trefa 12 months. Right? Rav Moshe Feinstein says it, Kluger, that's the accepted understanding of Chai Olam. Chai Olam is 12 months. Anything short of 12 months is Chai Shah.
Is under 30 days a different level?
No. Good question. Halachically, no. We talk about Chai Olam, Chai Shah, and then there could be an issue within Chai Shah. Is it worth... That's a separate issue. Do you go for more Chai Shah when you have a little less Chai Shah? We can talk about that. We will. But we have a more obvious, simple issue here. Can you risk your Chai Shah, meaning Chai Shah would have been the month, which is what you're getting at, right? Can you risk losing that month? Because you might have Nisa Miyad, 90% chance, Nisa Miyad, and you're giving up the Chai Shah, right? For the purpose of what? Gaining, potentially, Chai Olam. That's the major shiloh for the fetus. From the perspective of the fetus, can we allow this fetus to risk his Chai Shah that he would get? He'd get his 30 days. Let's assume he'll definitely get the 30 days. It doesn't always work that way. But he's certainly going to get more than what this procedure is going to give him. The procedure, 90%, is going to kill him on the spot. So he's giving up Chai Shah a certain amount of time, but not for nothing. He's giving up for the potential of Chai Olam. So that's a very, very famous old shiloh which we're going to talk about. What else? Before we get to where, who's making the decision for the fetus? Who?
Yeah.
Who should?
Parents.
Well, you all have that Western bias. Really?
The fetus.
Really?
No, I mean... If it's a concern of life, it what? It doesn't have the capability here, but,
But what? You're joking.
Speak on behalf of the fetus, just like...
I don't know if the fetus can do it, but very, very smart fetus, maybe. Obviously, there are two choices. We'll make it three choices here. Three choices. It's either the parents, which is the gut reaction of everybody, and which is, you'll see in a minute, the conventional medical secular approach, or...
Doctor.
The doctor, independent of everybody else, the good old days,
third authority,
right, society, a court, some type of general representative of society. Those are our three options. Who should make that decision? So that's That's a secular bioethics issue, and it's also a very significant halachic issue that's not talked about that much, but Rosh Hashanah always mentions it. He's into this. And he always quotes the same makor that you're going to see inside in a minute. That this is the one, there's one tshuva that just talks about this, and it seems to be that's all I can find on the topic, really. And it's pretty definitive psak. So that's really issue number one. Who should make the decision? Once we decide who's making the decision, then how do they make the decision? There's a perspective of the fetus that we talked about. Chaye isha for chaye olam. What other perspective is there? The perspective of other, you mentioned it before. The mother. This mother's at risk here. This is not without risk for the mother. There's general anesthesia. We're poking her in the belly. We're doing all sorts of things. And in the real surgery, you're cutting her open. It's like major surgery. It's not a joke. What child is this? When you are besafek sakana, can you allow yourself to be in order to save somebody from a vadai sakana? That's another famous shiloh that impacts on what other issues? Kidney donation. Anyone ever think about donating a kidney to somebody? It's very in these days. Meaning, and I'm not making fun of it. Obviously, anyone who heard Michael Berman knows his attitude about it. But there's many advertisements lately. People are catching on to this plea for kidneys for their children or a relative or something. And it's becoming much more commonly done. How should you feel about it? Should you feel guilty? Do you have a chiyuv to donate your kidney to somebody? Or, on maybe a less dramatic level, bone marrow. I had somebody who I was very close with, who is a tzaddik, this person, and he had put himself into the bone marrow registry, and 10 years went by and never got called. In the middle of the busiest time of his life, he suddenly gets called. He's matched. His bone marrow matches. And he really is a good person if he really wants to do it, but it's a very inconvenient time for him. And he would have to give up a tremendous amount. Not to mention, he's getting very nervous about the procedure and what's involved in it. Should he feel any chiyuv to do it? To undergo the bone marrow donation procedure in order to save somebody else's life? So we'll answer that question as well. What else is a issue that's raised
obviously,
here?
Obviously, the starting point is what the status of the baby with each human being, because if it's not a full
good.
Life.
So that, are we going to talk about that anymore?
No,
but that is exactly, that is a very big issue here, because even if we determine, let's say, in our question, should I risk my life to save someone else? Yes, you should, right? And that guy certainly is chayev to keep his bone marrow, but that might not be true when I'm talking about the yerech imo ubar, right? The imo, and he's not in the Shama Gemura, maybe I don't have that chayev.
It's
not very relevant.
If there's not yerech imo, even though there's some kind of element of mitzicha by killed it by doing abortion, but maybe to risk your own life is still different for a fetus.
Yes. Okay, so we're gonna talk about that. Right. There's two ways of looking at it.
You said a high percentage of the baby dying soon after birth. Is there any issue of having to go six to the surgery or not? And the fact you're poking around.
No, what's the definition of a gosis? Did we talk about that? No. What's the difference between a trefa and a gosis? Trefa, yes. Gosis, no. A gosis is somebody in whom the process of death has begun, commenced. He's dying. A trefa is what? What's a trefa? This is going to come up over and over again. We should really know the difference. What? Trefa is somebody who has, right? In terms of kashrus, one of the 18 simanim of trefas, right? Halacha Moshe Sinai, what they are. Even though we're talking about this one day, Hashem, even though there's the tam for a trefa, right? Trefa is somebody who's going to die within the year because of this particular defect. But nowadays we contradict many of those. So does that mean what's a trefa changes? No, halacha Moshe Sinai, that's going to be a whole discussion of conflicts between the Torah Shebaal Peh and what contemporary science says. But the bottom line is, a trefa is somebody who has a defect that should kill them within a year, right? One of those defects. That this baby might be, right? A hole in the heart is one of them. But a gosis, no. Because a gosis is someone who the process of death has begun, and that has not happened until they start poking him. Then the process is begun. And then they're just killing a full full-fledged trait. They might have Yechai Miso, but it's a fetus anyway.
The fact you have this hole and the baby is going to develop, the baby has this hole, it's going to develop into a situation that once it's born, it's going to...
Not a ghosis. Ghosis means the actual process of death is begun. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik has a whole shiur he gives on this. It's in his Sefer, where he is very machmir on the definition of death. He's the most chumra shita of all the shitas. And he says, in order for someone to be declared dead, not only do you need brain death, circulatory death, you need respiratory death also. You need all three. He's the only one who says that. You need all three things to declare someone dead. So it's difficult shita with a lot of the sugyas that relate to death. So he answers it up with this. He says, well, this is all part of gesisa. This is the process of death is involved. That's what the sugyas, when they call this death, they mean the process of death has begun. And your ghost is once one of those systems go, and then it continues until they're all gone. We're going to talk about that at length, Mi'at Hashem, at the very end, when we get to the end of life. Getting back to the beginning of life, turn the page, and you'll see one that everybody left out is number 5. We mentioned the other 4, but number 5 is a biggie. Number 5 is experimental therapy, in and of its own right. Forget about all this fetal stuff and all that. Experimental therapy is something that everyone's going to encounter, unfortunately, to themselves or someone in their family sometime in their life, where you're going to be confronted with a decision about getting involved in experimental therapy. So we're going to talk about the concept of a refuah beduka, which is going to be important for a lot of issues, right? Like using it to be doche Shabbos. You need to be a refuah beduka to be doche Shabbos. So even if you think that you're doing something mishum pikuach nefesh, if it's just experimental, you can't do it. We'll see what that means. And then, to me, one of the biggest dilemmas facing myself and just doctors in general and families in general is B, withholding unproven treatments in desperate cases, which means the following. There is a unwritten, though sometimes written, medical law that all doctors know. And that is, if there is a treatment that is under investigation and there's an experimental protocol that is laid out, no matter how bad you feel for your patient, no matter how bad you feel for your own family member, you cannot break the protocol. Meaning, and unfortunately I experienced this myself with a family member, you have somebody who has no chance at all for survival. There's no treatment available. There's this great experimental treatment you're hearing about. I went through this. I was screaming and screaming at the lead investigator. Let me have this one hope of saving this person. And no, absolutely not. Because the way science can be very callous, and they're correct. There's no way to investigate something objectively and correctly without holding up this standard of we don't break the protocol.
No
matter how desperate the person is.
No way.
No breaking the protocol, meaning don't, I just want to let him in. He doesn't meet the criteria, I'm sorry. But he's going to die. They can't say anything. What are they going to say? We can't break the protocol, we're really sorry.
What's the reason?
So,
The
reason is because you will never have valid data and valid conclusions if you don't have rigid, very balanced criteria that you adhere to. Start breaking
yourself.
So what? I tried that. It's illegal. But which is another very famous question. Anyone ever hear that dilemma? What's it called? Who wrote the article? Somebody wrote an article on this. Mark Drach wrote an article, Heinz Dilemma, it's called. I got to tell you, unfortunately, I was dealing with my father in this situation, and I had 2 brothers also in the medical field, and we were conspiring to do what we had to do. I mean, from a family perspective, and we'll see, there's halachic merit to what I'm saying. Even though I have to admit, I wasn't thinking halachically at the time. I was totally emotional, right? We were conspiring to do something less than legal because, you know, we stood nothing to lose except our father. That's all we wanted to do, save him. But what does the halacha have to say about that type of thinking? That's going to be another issue. Because that comes up with this type of thing. If this family came to me and said, look, we were told 100% this baby's going to die, but we can do this experimental procedure, And I tell them, no, you can't because of that. Or should I tell them, yes? And if it's somebody in my family, does that make a difference? And it'll be interesting to see that it does make a difference. So, we're going to go through each of these issues one at a time. Obviously, not all of them today. Let's start with a decision-making for Ketanim. So if you look at page 2, there is, from the Committee on Bioethics of the American Academy of Pediatrics, this is the consensus. This is what all pediatricians will adhere to, what's said by this report. So, by them, the most important concept by any secular bioethicist is autonomy. Autonomy, autonomy, autonomy. That's all they care about. In my view, that's all they ever said. What does it mean? It means that when it comes to making decisions, complicated decisions about treatment, the patient has the full say in what should be done to them. Autonomy means is no one touches me, I have complete jurisdiction over myself, and no one else has a right to invade that autonomy. And they go as far as to say, actually, this group feels so strongly about this, they advocate that even the kids should have a say in the final decision. Now, from a very objective perspective, this makes a little bit of sense, right? We're about to do something invasive to somebody, possibly hurt them. They should have a say in that, right? So they'll push you to the point where, like, a 9-year-old kid has to be told what's going to be done to him. What if he says no? Okay, so that's another discussion. That they're not ready to say, well, if he says no, you can't do it. If he says yes, you do it. That they won't say. They just want you to tell him. But the parents, right, if you read the lines that are underlined, the parents conventionally have the say, just like all of you said. The parents are the ones. And already, this committee came up with the problem with that. Although physicians should seek parental permission in most situations, they must focus on the goal of providing appropriate care and be prepared to seek legal intervention when parental refusal places the patient at clear and substantial risk. How often do you think that happens? How often do you think that, first of all, let's say, how often do you think parents make the wrong decision from the doctor's perspective, meaning they refuse treatment when you really are advising them to do it? Just give me a subjective one. Fairly rare? Rarely? Very rarely?
I don't think so.
No, it's not that rare.
I don't think it's rare at all.
It's not common. You're from the old school, right? when the doctors... I'm saying in your statement, it's from the old school. That you are certainly from the new school. But your statement is the old style. When doctors, what doctors said, that was it. Who's going to argue with a doctor? Nowadays, autonomy, autonomy, autonomy. We're nothing. Why do you think I try to switch? No. The bottom line is, doctors are, there's a backlash. If you turn the page, actually, the opposite is what's going on nowadays. And this is in that same article written by these very, very liberal bioethicists. There is a backlash from the day when doctor knew best. It's paternalistic. Everything's paternalistic. I hear it coming out of my ears, right? You're trying to lead other people's lives, right? Because, you know, who knows what's best for the children? You? The doctor? Right? What do you know?
The
parents know. and the fetus and the child, right? Everybody's getting into the fun of it. Now, as much as I sound negative about this, which I am, you'll see why in a minute, there is a plus. There is a plus with this attitude from people. I'll tell you that much. From people have one advantage with Baruch Hashem this has really helped with, and then that is from people often want to get a posek thereof involved in a family way for decisions like this. This enables it. So on the one hand, as much as I'm going to show you that halacha is going to circumvent it, there is an advantage for from people that can't be denied and is worth it. Because since there's so much autonomy to the patient, now doctors can't do things against halacha. They have to wait for the family consents, which very often allows you to then get a psak and do it the right way. But, strictly speaking, as a case-by-case basis of doctor to patient, what would halacha say about this? I am advocating for my patient what I think is in their best interest based on what? Based on my gut feeling? Based on my being a nice guy? No. It's based on my spending a lot of time learning all this material, spending a lot of time being involved in it, having experience, I have an instinct, I know risk-benefit in a much more thorough sense than parents could ever, no matter how many times I explained it to them. Who should be laying under either setting? So it becomes a real problem. If you look on the bottom of page 3, I just gave you some examples. They give practical applications of where you must get the parents' consent on the bottom of page 3. So immunizations. Has anyone in this room not gotten immunizations? You don't have to admit it publicly. There are many people out there. And why? There are some people, right? Those are women. I don't want to be too chauvinistic, but many women have mothers because they're very concerned with their children and they read things. They read unusual things. Think immunizations are responsible for so many horrible things, right? Autism, the MMR shot is the cause of autism. That is like dogma. There's suits, there are lawsuits going on. I know people making millions of dollars out of this. No proof. There's no scientific data. There's nothing to suggest that other than, you know, innuendo and just weak associations. But people have become very biased against immunization. So I will say, I know the data. I know that, you know, what happens to people that don't get immunizations. I know the incidence of disease if you don't have it, if you do have it. I know the likelihood of this autism and all that other stuff. Take the immunization. You're crazy. So I need to get parental consent. We all often agree with that. Invasive diagnostic testing. That's another one. People have a phobia of it, but a doctor's weighing. He's weighing. I know there's a risk. I can tell you percentage-wise what the risk is. Right? And I'm weighing that in my decision for the information that I can get from that. I don't have to go through all the examples. The bottom line is the doctor definitely knows 1,000 times better, no matter how well-meaning the parents are, and no matter how much you try to inform them. They could never get it the way you got it based on years and years of experience.
But this is different from immunizations, or that's standard practice, and this is sort of pushing at the edges, like we said before about the college who wanted it.
Excellent.
It would have been 13.
Excellent question. Right. Everyone hear the question? Good question. Right?
There's something to suspect.
Good.
As far as the doctor.
So who says the doctor knows any better on a case like that? Right?
No, not saying the doctor knows better, but
they might have their own agenda.
We said before the doctor is making the decision based on
they have their own
comprehensive knowledge. But I think the doctor could just want to extend the knowledge and not have the interest of the patient. First.
Oh, 100%. 100%. I would never say, I'm not advocating against second opinions and being as discerning as you can of the abilities and the sort of purpose of the doctor and his intentions. That you always got to be very, very careful with. And more than that, I would advocate that, you know, questions like this are halakhic questions. They're halakhic questions as well as medical questions. In medicine, the facts will be provided by the medical side of this, and then the final decision on a case like this, the one we're talking about, to me, has to be exact. It's such a difficult case. There's no right or wrong. Take the 90% chance this way. Take the 90. I don't know. I need help from the Rebbe Shalom to make that kind of decision. I need exact. That's where, you know, in the partnership, in the formulation of halacha between Hashem and man, we need divine input into this. There's no logic to say Chai Yishev, Chai Olam, as far as I'm concerned. Maybe other people feel differently, but it becomes a halachic shaila for sure when we're dealing with a case like I mentioned before. 100%. But in terms of who makes the decision, right? Who makes the decision? So the psak is the decision to some degree, but on the level of a simpler decision in medicine, where maybe it's the psak is whatever is medically best, that decision is going to be made by the parents or the doctor. Pshita. To me, it's pshita. And to Rav Tzvi Hoffman also. So if you turn the page, page 4, you see this is the halachic input into this shayla. It says in the Shulchan Aruch, Nitna hatar reshus lerofe lerafos u'mitzvahi u'bichlal pikuach nefeshu v'imoneh atzmo harei zeh shofech dam. That's the guiding principle for a doctor. Once you've taken the very, very significant responsibility of becoming a doctor, which is incredibly big-time responsibility, you're saying you're willing to put people's lives in your hands, right? Once you're going to do that, don't be shofech damim. you got to know what you're doing, and you got to always put your pride aside, all sorts of criteria to be a good doctor, right? And do it. You got to save the person's life. So starting with that, if you look at this tshuva, he doesn't just entertain the obvious case. Look at the shaila, and look at days. Well, the person's looking out. Let's look at the whole thing. Shaila, chiyuv al harofe la'asos chituch l'refua, operation. Gamim ha'avos shel hatinok hachole lo yirtzu b'kach. V'zos ha'shala nechlet. There's two nechalekes, two parts to the shaila. Im harofe choshev, operation medir refua. That's number one. Here, he's talking about a case where the doctor's not wavering. You know? I really think he uses choshev because there's no yediyah in medicine. That's only Torah, right? But in medicine, we can think, right? We think we're right. Science thinks things. Science has theories and speculation. So, but it means that the doctor really is saying, this is the way to go. That's Aleph. Beis, im gam libo megam gen, shetifol ha'operation, pe'ulat tova. He's not really sure, but it might work. But what's the alternative? Low operation, the vademes. That kind of case. Very similar to ours. But ours might even be worse, right? More than the gum. It's like 90% that it won't. But the psak is very clear. Umeata came on the shari lasos. We're going to see how he determined that it's mutter to do this operation. That's one of our topics, right? That's chai shara chai ol. He says, Imken Bavade Das Avi the Imo Lomaila Lomorit. Right? Because look, in Yeradeyat says the doctor has to save lives. Who care and who said that a parent has a right to jeopardize the life of their child? What's he taking for granted? Pshita, that the doctor, in terms of who has better judgment as to whether this is in the best interest of healing and the life of the patient, who better than the doctor? Obviously the doctor does. And he should, even in Megamgen cases, he should have the say. And he says, Zeru adin Torah, v'dina de machuse eini yodei b'ofim. I can tell you what it is. Dina de machuse is the other way. Definitely the other way. I had a case just before I came to Eretz Yisrael, and this was my experience with bioethical commissions. There was a child who had a condition where there was a surgery that had 75% survival. 75%, it's not good. You don't want to be in that position. But it's not like 90% mortality. 75% was good. It involved a significant surgery, a full day surgery. The parents said no. I said, wait, you want to save your baby? If you say no, 100% mortality. I couldn't take them to court. But I at least said, let me get the bioethics committee involved. They weren't Jewish. But I wasn't prepared as a doctor to advocate something that I thought was totally incorrect. Totally incorrect. So we had the bioethics committee, and they recognized my problem, meaning they were willing to meet. Right? If they don't think you have a case at all, they won't meet, and they won't get together with the family. They'll just say, listen to what the parents say and get lost. But here they were willing to meet, and the purpose of the meeting was to mollify me and just sort of let the parents do what they want. And that was really what they were. That was the upshot of this type of meeting. It isn't viewed ever differently, unless it's something blaringly obvious, like a Seventh-day Adventist. Everyone knows who they are, right?
The Shinsadists, the same people.
Right. They don't believe in blood transfusions. Adam hu anefesh. They take very literally, and they don't want Uncle Charles would be living inside of somebody else or something. You know, they don't want any transformation of souls or whatever the issue is. So it's a big no-no to do a blood transfusion. But, certain operations, you just can't do it that way. If you don't get a blood transfusion, you don't have a patient at the end of the day. So this is the one case where you're able to take them to court because they can make that decision for themselves, believe it or not. And they're allowed to forego blood transfusions, but the courts don't let them do it to their kid. Other than something as obvious as that, these other kind of situations, the secular world will always go with the parents. Rav Shechter quotes this Melamed Lahoil very often. In halacha, it is the doctor in this type of situation that has the say in terms of what is in the best interest.
What would you say? How far do you have to go? I mean, what happens if you do the operation and get fired? You could be put into prison. How far do you have to go?
That's a big question. So, what is that avera that you're committing if you let it go? So if it's a Jew, then you're doing. So for a lav, I guess you got to give up your whole parnasa. If it's that simple,
you could be put into prison.
So then it gets a little more complicated. It's a good shaila I have to ask. But for a non-Jew, you don't have lo tamei lo tamei reyecha. You know, I guess some type of, I don't know what the issue would be exactly. And maybe a chomesh, but you're certainly not required to give up your entire parnasa and be fired. It would come down to that kind of cheshbon on that. But it's a great question because, I asked that child in this case, how far do I take this? I was told, you took it as far as you should take it. That was what I was told. But it was an easy one. It would be trickier if we were dealing with a motion. If it was really an obvious case, you can't take them to court. I mean, you should even from the secular perspective, like the transfusions case. But on the more subtle ones, you're right. It's a very good shot to look into it a little more.
My questions are quite related to that. Mm-hmm. For the ruling of the Shofar Roche, the Mechaber, when he says, are we talking about is a goy included, or maybe under the category of Darkei Shalom? I mean, this maybe we'd say b'din a goy is not necessarily included, or even before we get to Darkei Shalom. The second question, which is related also to what Abraham was asking, is a very fixed situation. I'm sure that Rabbi is familiar. This is a doctor's in a situation in a mall where a person gets a heart attack. If it's a Jew or not Jew, I don't know if it makes a difference. Does this doctor have to risk malpractice to save this person?
What always makes the difference between a Jew and a non-Jew is the law of lo tamei lo tamei reyecha, right? So for a Jew, it's always very easy to answer this type of question. There is a chiyuv, lo tamei lo tamei reyecha. What is that chiyuv? Is there a chiyuv for all of us to learn to be doctors? No. There's a chiyuv with whatever you got at the time to not be omed on tamei reyecha, right? So if you're a doctor, that means that's what you are. And if Re'echa is lying there, in my opinion, you got to do everything you can to intervene.
How do you know if he's a goy or a Jew, though? Most Jews aren't.
Right, so you go with the robe. You know, if you're in the middle of Bar Apar, Flatbush means one thing, Tinet.
Israel.
And, it's Israel, forget about it, obvious. Then I would say, robe would say, just get involved. If you knew for sure it was a non-Jew, so again, Bizmaneinu, that's an easy question, right? We're going to get into this in depth when we talk about Pikuach Nefesh on Shabbos in particular, right? But just on the Lachas to answer that question, Lemaisa, because of Eva, not just because of Eva Pikuach Nefesh, there's no difference. You can't just start saving Jews' lives and not non-Jews' lives. We have plenty of time, right? So that Bizmaneinu, the way communications are, right? Even if you think in your local area it's not gonna, you can get away with it or something, it's just the gamble is too significant, and somewhere somebody's going to be affected by it. Some Jewish life, like for example, like with transplants. That's where I encountered it. I had this kid who needed a transplant. Remember I told you? I told you. And the transplant people didn't want to do it because he was from, and they heard from people, don't donate. So they were making the decision very illegally. Totally illegally, between me and them, they were telling me, with a bias. And just all you need is a little bias like that. Oh, Jews don't save non-Jews on Shabbos? Or some Jews don't? All right, so we'll be a little more lax about how we're going to treat Jews in the hospital, too. We'll take a few more chances. That's all you need. That's Pikuach Nefesh. So it's Yishum Nef. It's the only reason, Lamaisa, really, that is the consensus opinion that you're allowed to give a Shabbos for a non-Jew. With the exception of that sheet, which you have to definitely elaborate upon all the time. We also have to understand, why is that so? It isn't because I feel like I have to just clarify this a little more. This is not our topic at all. It's okay. It's important to realize, when I gave this shiur, the person who wrote the article that had claimed, remember I told you before, someone wrote an article saying it was Rav Soloveitchik that said it. So this person wrote this article in a journal that all doctors across America get. So every rabbi in the world tells them don't do it, because even if you're coming out with a nice answer at the end, just to have in print in English the concept that Jews will not save the life of non-Jews is a chilul Hashem of the greatest proportions. But the guy did it anyway. So I'm about to start my shiur in a shul in Tinek, and I don't know why it hit me, but before I began to talk, I was going to really rip into this person, because I thought he did a terrible thing, anonymously, but I figured maybe someone in the audience knows the guy, knows he wrote this article. So I asked, does anyone know anything about this article? Suddenly a guy pops up and says, I wrote it. There he was, the man. He had seen the topic advertised, and this apparently was a pet peeve of his. And unbeknownst to me, he was my neighbor for 6 years. He didn't ask me who it is. And you guys don't know. But very, very nice person. Like, in other words, look what's bothering him. This should bother people. This is a very difficult issue. And it was something that just, you know, he was a committed Jew, but this was, if there was one thing that was going to be his problem, this was his problem. So he wanted an explanation. So his first statement is, how could you tell me this isn't biased? So I'll give you a very simple answer. What do you mean biased? I mean, we favor Jews over non-Jews? That's what it is, genetic, it's a real racism. What do you think the din is for a Jew who's a total min, a total apikos, total machal shams, but hesya, mezid? What's the din for him? Can you be machal shams for him? Absolutely not. Same din as for the Jew. See, that alone is proof this is not a racist issue. So we have to understand it a little better. This is a topic that we'll get to in a few months. I'm not going to do it right now, but there is some understanding we can get to. The starting point is it's not racist. It definitely is not. It has to do with the fundamentals of what Kiyum Shabbos is about. What does it mean to be somebody who Shomer Shabbos? What does it mean, the mitzvah of Shmir Shabbos? What does that mean? What does that neshama mean? That's the issue. And we'll see. It comes out in the Sigyas and in the discussion of the Quran. I think we're going a little too far with this. We'll stop for now. Mitzvah Hashem, we'll get to that topic at the end of the course. But next week, we will continue really getting into this issue of Chai Isha. We'll start with that. Chai Isha, call it Chai Olam. Chai Isha, Chai Olam.
I don't know. I
don't
know. I don't know. I don't know. Of course, I think almost every post-sig nowadays rules that. But for instance, I'm not